like 65, and I think I maybe have heard of like two of them. So, yeah, I'm pumped. Put that fourth wave right into my veins.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Jay and Joey on the Record.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Joey. This is the second episode as we chip away at Jay's record collection throughout one calendar year. Jay, what's on the docket today?
So today we are going to do five more of my top 10 favorite albums. We are going to be talking about The Cars' debut album, The Cars. Next, we will be talking about Warren Zevon's Excitable Boy. And then we will move into a couple of early hard rock albums with Led Zeppelin's fourth album, The Who, Who's Next. And then we will finish up with Let It Bleed by the Rolling Stones.
Stone Cold classic, rippers, bangers from start to finish. Hold on to your butts.
Let's kick it off with the newest one of the five. So let's talk about The Cars.
The Cars, okay.
So this is The Cars' self-titled debut album. Came out on June 6, 1978 on Elektra Records. Have you heard?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This one, I dig the hell out of this album. It's very influential in a lot of things I really like. With this and Candy O, solid 1-2 debut follow-up releases.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to beat this one as a debut. I love this album from start to finish. So I was doing a little research on it, and a lot of the tracks on the album were actually like demos and stuff that the band had been playing in local bars for a really long time. What do you think of revisiting this album?
Yeah, I like it maybe even more now. It's just a freaking cool album. I love that it opens with the song made most famous by Power Man 5000, Good Times Roll.
Is that right? Real?
Yeah. Power Man 5000 covered Good Times Roll.
What? I would have to check this out.
Yeah, it's a piece of work. It's Power Man 5000.
It is what it is. You should come in expecting PM5K. But what a great song to open the album. Let the good times roll. Hell yeah, let's go. I love that. This whole album is, and that song in particular, but the entire album is such a cool mix of like guitar rock and then like synth pop. So it's like the best of both of those things to me.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, it's hard to describe it other than cool in any other way. Like the claps on My Best Friend's Girl. And it just the opening three tracks are Heavyweight Status.
What do you think of track four on the front side, I'm In Touch With Your World? Do you have any notes on that one? That one was weird as Looney Tunes cartoon sounds going on in the background.
Yeah, so I did have a note on that. It's so tweaky and weird. It's definitely the outlier of the album, in my opinion. I imagine Kevin Barnes from Of Montreal heard this and immediately thought, I'm starting a band, because there's so much of Montreal that I can hear just directly derives from that album or from that track. What did you think of it?
Obviously, it's the weirdest track on the album, but I also have in my notes that in a weird way, it really fits with the rest of what's going on. So, I mean, like you said, the first three songs are massive. Good Times Roll, My Best Friend's Girl, Just What I Needed. Most people are going to know those. And then it hits you with this, where it's like 15 pieces of percussion and all sorts of weird little sound effects going on. But at the same time, I think it fits in with the rest of the album.
Then bleeding right into Don't Just Stop, which is weird, but still accessible. We talked about this briefly. It seems like every song on this album was a single or has been licensed in one way, shape, or form.
Yes, but that's exactly right. But one of my favorite things about this and just listening to albums in general, this was put together with intent. So like, especially on side two, the songs don't really like fade in or fade out. It's just like You're All I've Got Tonight, boom, stops. Bye Bye Love immediately starts. And it's cool how they really kind of flow into each other. It was cool to sit there and listen to that.
Yeah, the movement of the last few tracks is really nice. You mentioned Bye Bye Love, that or Moving in Stereo, the track right after that. Those might be my two favorite tracks off this.
And it's heavier than it probably would get credit for. I mean, like Bye Bye Love, there's some sweet little guitar fills in there. The one before You're All I've Got Tonight, it's got some nice distorted guitar, but then there's always in the background of the cars that cool synth sound going on that just makes it, you know, that early late 70s, early 80s synth pop sound. That's just awesome, especially Moving in Stereo.
I would have loved to have known what people thought of this the first time they heard it on the radio, because it was so different than what was mainstream and what was popular at that time. And we mentioned about how commonplace and how well known these tracks are now. I mean, at that time, it had to be kind of groundbreaking and earth shattering.
Absolutely. But at the same time, they're still pop songs to me. Like, they're really catchy. People, like you said, it's doing that thing where it's kind of calling back to like early 60s, late 50s, kind of the hand clap, real catchy kind of stuff. But yeah, it's exactly as you described it. It's cool and new and innovative. And for those of you who maybe have never heard this album or heard of the Cars, but have seen the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the scene where Judd Reinhold's character is like, well, having a fantasy about Phoebe Cates' character taking her top off, that's Moving in Stereo playing in the background there. So like a cool, sexy, just badass synth sound. That's just, I love it.
Any other notes?
I mean, I would just say that, you know, the reason I chose this album to be in my top 10 is the fusion, like I've already said, of the guitar playing and the synth. It's just a cool combination of both of those things. It's just a cool album. Cool is how I would describe it. How about yourself?
Yeah, I think that's perfect. It's an album that I listen to and I think I'm cool in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. So you want to move on to the next one?
Yeah, man. So the second one here is Excitable Boy by Warren Zevon. This album was released on January 18th, 1978 on Asylum Records. It's Warren Zevon's third studio album. What'd you think?
I can actually remember the exact day that I heard this album for the first time, which I'll get into here in a second. Yeah, tell me your thoughts and why you chose this.
So it's funny you say that, because I actually also can remember the first time I heard this album.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And, you know, it's in my top 10 favorite albums. It probably, I mean, tomorrow it probably wouldn't be. It may be in a week or whatever, but it holds a little bit of significance to me because, you know, the first time I heard it, I was with one of my very best friends, and it was a Friday afternoon in college. And we said, well, what are we doing this weekend? And I went to college in a little town called Manhattan, Kansas. We said, well, hell, let's drive to the Black Hills and go check out Mount Rushmore. So we drove basically all night, and he only had a couple functioning CDs in the car, and this was one of them. And we listened to it on repeat the entire trip. So that's the first time I heard it, and I just fell in love with the lyrics. I love Warren Zevon's lyrics. They're dark, they're funny, they're great. And this album is a very, very representative of his dark and funny lyrics.
Poetic, very descriptive. His words, just, you know, paintings unfold before you. Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, so many songs are descriptive and read like a scroll of brilliance, but there's something about that one in particular where you kind of wonder, how did this person get this concept of someone getting their head blown off by, you know, someone turning on them.
Right. And then they got to hunt him down headless, wandering the continent of Africa, trying to find this guy to get revenge. Like, what a great song. And that's just one of them on this album that's like that. You know, you've got Excitable Boy, which super dark, very upbeat kind of sounding song, but it's about a guy who just continually does worse and worse things, more and more awful things. And they just keep letting him off the hook for it. So he's just an excitable boy. They just excuse it. And I love that song. It's super dark, but it's hilarious.
You see it so much, and it's so commonplace now where someone's actions get excused. Oh, he's just joking, or oh, he didn't mean it, or oh, well, he didn't directly say that. You know, it's just innuendo.
Yeah. Sounds like old Donnie Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, this was, you know, a little over 40 years ago, and now this overly excusing their actions and turning them into a caricature of themselves while ignoring the possible outcomes and,
right,
and, you know, not realizing that there is intent and there are consequences. And I mean, we saw it on January 6th, and God knows what the next few days will hold. We're recording this before a few days before the release. And it's frightening, honestly.
It truly is. But that's why, I don't know. I mean, it's dark, but he kind of, Zevon adds a little humor to it. So, I mean, and there's a couple of Lawyers, Guns, and Money, kind of dark too. The last song on the album is about a guy, a pretty spoiled sort of guy in, I think it's implied, Central America, just kind of having a good time doing drugs and stuff and getting in trouble and then calling for Lawyers, Guns, and Money to help bail him out. Like, I love it. Oh, I was just saying it's a catchy tune on top of that. I mean,
yeah.
Send Lawyers, Guns, and Money, the shit has hit the fan. Like, what a great lyric.
Yeah, so I, as I said, yeah, I remember the exact day I heard this. This is the day he died. He died my sophomore year of college, and I remember that because he died a few days before Johnny Cash. And I had a friend who was bummed out, and I was familiar with Warren Zevon's singles. Didn't know too much about the man beyond that. The first thing I thought was Meatloaf and Jim Steinem with less gusto, but it grew on me. Swagger, a lot of power chords. I love how present the vocals are on this album. It's a solid album. So, of course, for me, a standout track is going to be Accidentally Like a Martyr. My goodness. I mean, it's heartbreaking. I just want to bask in it. The War on Drugs do a phenomenal cover of this. If you haven't heard it, they played it in Boston. And my first thought when they played it was, you know, we don't deserve this cover. It was just so remarkably well done. And they have a live album that just came out last year that I know they played this on. So if you haven't heard it, you can hear it on there.
And then I guess the last thing I'll say about this album, if you don't know who Warren Zevon is, Werewolves of London is Warren Zevon, and that's on this album. And we didn't really talk about it very much. Did you know that the rhythm section for Fleetwood Mac is the rhythm section on Werewolves in London? So you've got Mick Fleetwood on the drums and John McVie playing bass.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, with that said, by all accounts, he seemed like a truly difficult person, quite complicated. And of course, there's a deeper discussion there about separating art from the artists and legacy after death and romanticism, that you need suffering and personal trauma to produce great art. But yeah, the story, it's a complicated one. It's too long for this. But there is a good article on The Ringer from a couple years ago about him that I think is definitely worth reading about making peace with a legacy of an artist like this. So yeah, if the listeners haven't heard it, definitely check it out.
Yeah, he's a really complicated dude for sure. There's a lot going on with Warren Zevon. All right. So next on the docket, let's talk about Led Zeppelin. So this is Led Zeppelin's fourth album. A lot of people are going to call it Led Zeppelin 4. It's actually technically an untitled album. It came out November 8, 1971 on Atlantic Records, following the release of Led Zeppelin 3 in 1970. Led Zeppelin took a break from live shows to focus on writing a follow-up record. And the reason this is untitled, and potentially the reason why they took some time to put it together, is Led Zeppelin 3 kind of didn't have the best critical reception right off the jump. And they left this untitled because they were kind of pissed off about things.
Were they pissed off at the reception and how people perceive them, or were they more pissed off at themselves artistically?
I think
the headspace. Okay.
Reception. I'll tell you why. Because the album itself does not have a single word on it on the outside. There's no title on the outside. There's nothing on the outside. It doesn't say Led Zeppelin anywhere. There's not even a number on the spine of the album, like pretty much every album ever in existence has. They kind of said, I mean, in my opinion, they said, screw you. We are good. We know we're good. People will find this album. It's going to be a monster. And it was.
I don't think I realized that about the spine. I own this on vinyl. So
that's... Is your eightfold version that you can, the open up version?
It is.
So you've got the dude on the inside with like the lantern and dressed like a
Yeah.
How sweet that.
Dude, so I took this art class in 11th grade where we had to make like a clay sculpture, and my clay sculpture was the druid with the lantern. And I mean, it looked like a turd, but
I'm sure countless bongs throughout the history of time to resemble this druid dude with the lantern. It's what is it actually called? Artwork is, it has a name, but I don't remember what it's called. It's my bad.
Yeah, man. The Druid Man was big for me for a couple of years. Have you ever played this backwards? I know there are all those.
What?
No. Okay. There's the rumor of, I mean, pretty much like any mainstream 70s rock album that's like, oh, if you play this backwards, it's going to have satanic messages. And I've never done it because I know it screws your records up, but I'm so curious because to me, I imagine if you listen to anything garbled, you can pick out the message you want, but
you can make up your own message. Absolutely.
Yes. So yeah, the songs, the music, we haven't even touched on it yet.
Yeah. So like you said, you were big into it at one point, left it, coming back to it. What stuck out to you upon revisiting it?
We're about to get into hot takes territory, and I've gotten some heat from a Paul Simon takes last week, but so at first when you hear hey mama, I was just like transplanted back to a high school classroom. But then the more I got into the album, I got really irritated at a lot of tracks, but then a few tracks I oddly appreciated more.
So I kind of was on the same train as you, honestly. Like, I love this album. And I still think it's great. Obviously, I picked it as a top 10, but going through it, you know, Battle of Evermore is kind of just blah. Just
yes,
wailing away on a mandolin and just kind of howling. One thing, though, about that one, that is the only Led Zeppelin song in existence where there is a female vocalist. Sandy Denny was her name.
Huh. Was she in any other bands, or did she have it?
Fairpoint Convention. I don't know what that is, but okay. That's the band she was in.
I wonder if they had any success after this. If they got to ride the four wave for a little bit.
I kind of imagine like maybe they had some success before this because I don't know. Mm-hmm. I assume they recorded this in like a house in the English countryside. They brought in a mobile studio to record this. So I assume she had to go to the house. So Battle of Evermore in particular was created when Jimmy Page was just kind of messing around with a mandolin. He didn't even really play the mandolin. He kind of came up with this. It's not great. I'm not a huge fan of it.
Yeah.
So in my notes, I've got rock and roll. At the time, I'm sure it was a fairly cool, heavy, you know, song. But in 2021, it feels like a song that was designed to sell Buicks to baby boomers. Like, that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, yeah. It's unfortunate the turn that it's taken, but I mean,
Stairway still rocks.
Yeah, it still does. In fact, maybe I liked it more, or I appreciated kind of the movements and elements of it more. One track that I think still holds up really well for me, and I'm going to caveat this by saying I think it's the best Led Zeppelin song, which is funny because it's not their song. And I think it's an all-time great rock song, is When the Levee Breaks.
So that song is originally a 1929 Delta Blues song by the same name by Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe McCoy.
If you're familiar with Led Zeppelin and you haven't heard the original, definitely you can find it on YouTube pretty easily. It's like 3 minutes long, which is actually pretty long for a song in 1929. But I mean, they take that 3 minutes and turn it into eight or whatever it was on the album. And I love it. I think it would be a great WrestleMania entrance song. Like you're just strolling down that long ramp and soaking in the boos and jeers and cheers.
Getting ready to throw somebody off of a steel cage.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you have more Led Zeppelin in the collection. It kind of feels like closing a chapter for me, though, which is sad in a little ways, but I'll always have those memories. How do you feel?
I'm still going to listen to Led Zeppelin. Come on. It wasn't front to back as good as I remember it from the last time I listened to it. I mean, Going to California is still great. I do enjoy that one. I love an acoustic guitar. I like it when they get into their, you know, blues stuff. So, you know, like When the Levee Breaks is, it's just a locomotive of a track. You've got the guitar sounding like a blues harmonica. Same thing with Black Dog. And then the rest of it's just kind of, well, whatever. But we're gonna...
Friends, there's never been a better time than now to join Instacart. And we're here to tell you how you can get free shipping on your first order of $35 or more. If you've never used Instacart before, it's so easy to use. You'll be able to order products from the stores you love in a single order. Everything is hand-selected by shoppers based on your preferences, and they can deliver your goods to you in as fast as 1 hour. Look, we've all been at home for a while, and we all need some inspiration to help us become the home chefs we all hope to be. Instacart will make smart suggestions for new items to help inspire you, and they even highlight deals to help you save money. Interested in joining Instacart? Just follow the link in the show notes. This will let Instacart know that we sent you, and it will help support the show. Thanks.
Jump into the Who here. Who's next? I have notes about that. So this one came out August 14th, 1971. This is the Who's fifth studio album. Pete Townsend composed all of the tracks on the album, other than My Wife, and they were... actually
just composed by Borat.
Yes. And they were intended to be part of a Tommy style rock opera. I did not know this until I started.
Really?
Yes. It was going to be called Lifehouse.
Now I'm curious if any other works were supposed to be rock operas until they finally made it to.
I am too. And I know I think there were at least a couple tracks that were intended to be on the Lifehouse project that surfaced later on that weren't on this one. I don't know what they are. I did not dig too far into that, but I do know this was intended to be a rock opera.
So if it was Lifehouse, one of the tracks was probably Hanging by a Moment. Do you know what the concept was supposed to be?
I wish I did, but I don't. I don't really know, to be honest with you. I looked into it, but I couldn't really hash it out.
Let's get into your thoughts on this one.
First of all, let me just say the Who in particular, they do have a special place for me. I've been listening to the Who for as long as I've been listening to music. I think if you ask my dad what his favorite bands are, he would tell you the Who would be one of the first three things he said. And I've been listening to it since I've grown up. So, you know, I'm very, very familiar with all of these songs as songs, but it had been a while since I've actually sat down and listened to this album front to back. And I think I appreciate the songs as songs now that I've heard them on the album.
I agree with you about being a Who person. I was always a Who guy. Them and the Kinks were always my big British bands. Like later in life, I've listened to the Kinks more, but I mean, from debut until Keith Moon's death, their run was unbelievable. I mean, they didn't put out very many sloppy productions. And I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, their stuff from Who's Next on is actually the strongest stuff they made, which is rare, like very rare.
For me, this is their best album, though. Obviously, I picked it for my top 10. But I mean, this one and the next album we're going to talk about, actually, they come in and go out on two just phenomenal songs. So this one starts with Baba O'Reilly, which you've probably seen on like LimeWire as Teenage Wasteland or something.
Yes.
But it's actually called Baba. And it's, I mean, a nice, simple, yet effective song to me. I mean, you got the synth loop running in the background, thunderous bass. And that's the one thing about this entire album that really sticks out to me. Entwistle throughout the entire album, his bass is just all over the place. He's such a monster bass player. He's playing like lead bass. If you actually listen to what he's playing, if you listen to the bass isolated, it's incredible. He's one of the best that's ever been.
Yeah, he was my dude in the Who. I actually had tickets to see the Who in Cleveland, I want to say, before he died, actually. And he was the driving force about why I wanted to see him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's such a beast. And so so I mentioned that, you know, Townsend wrote all the songs, but my wife, and that was actually written by Entwistle here, and he was the lead vocalist as well.
A track like Bargain, how can you just not strut and belt out, you know, when it's the best I've ever had? That part, it's just so bombastic and so anthemic, and it just, it enshrouds you. And I mean, you're transported. I love it.
Yeah, it's very anthemic album. I mean, getting in tune is also kind of like that. I mean, it starts out with just Roger Daltrey out there just singing his one note because it fits in tune with the chord that he's playing. And then it just crescendos to this big anthem. Like, I love it. That's one of the main reasons I love The Who. There's another Who song that's on a totally different album, but Joined Together with the Band, like, just gets me all fired up just to get going, man. That's what this album is.
Yeah, with Getting in Tune, I wrote that I adore the swagger, those keys. It's an album that lingers. It can be in the forefront or in the background, and regardless of how much you're paying attention to it, it's going to penetrate your core.
Did you have any tracks that really stood out more? That, and I'm sure you've probably heard all of them before, but did you have any that really stuck out more this time than before?
One specific thing that stood out to me more this time was the harmonies on In Behind Blue Eyes, and kind of the buildup. You know, it starts off solemn, peaceful, serene, and I mean, this field of daisies quickly turns into a thunderstorm.
That's funny you say that, because my notes for that song, I wrote like eight words: acoustic, bass, Daltrey, harmonies, build up. That's what I have for that song. And that's, I mean, it's kind of what you just described. I wrote really, man, but it's true. I mean, it really is just kind of like a huge song. They're all huge. They're all monstrous songs. Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yeah.
That's the Daltrey scream that we kind of, that you did in the background when we started this thing. But I mean, hell yeah. If that doesn't get you just kind of ready to rock. If you are a bass player and you like listening to bass, this album, John Entwistle, crushing it. There's the reason his nickname is Thunderfingers. Dude is all over this. That's it. That's all I gotta say.
What a nickname. Can you?
Thunderfingers, and then
imagine
the Ox. Yeah. He's also known as the Ox.
How do I get a nickname like Thunderfingers? I mean, on the surface, it sounds kind of goofy. But then you hear it and you're like, oh yeah, he's pretty much sent down from Mount Olympus to give us bass.
It's such a woolly sound too. Like, it's really just fuzzy, woolly bass, really thick, but it's beautiful. I love it. Anyway, that's enough of me talking about bass. I love bass. I'll talk bass all day.
So you wanna talk about the Rolling Stones, Let It Bleed?
Let's do it. Last one for today is Let It Bleed by the Rolling Stones. It was released December 5th, 1960. On Decca Records. I know you like the Stones.
Yeah, this for me, this is the second best Stones album by hair. I'm putting Exile on Main Street above it. They're speaking of great stretch music, their stretch from Beggar's Banquet to Exile on Main Street is untouchable. Those four albums, I mean, I can't think of any artist who has put out four phenomenal, you know, 4.5, 5-star albums like that in a row. Right. I'm sure if I pick my brain, New Order might be close. That's bias. But it's a solid stretch. And then they fell off a cliff after that.
Sure did.
So guide us through some of your tracks, maybe a little bit of your history with this album, how you got into the Stones.
So let's see, my history with not particularly this album, but the Rolling Stones in general. I mentioned last week, the first CD I ever purchased for myself was Metallica's Black album. But prior to that, I was given a couple of CDs by my uncle. And one of them was a Rolling Stones Greatest Hits album. And it's kind of hilarious because I just remembered the other one was a Cars Greatest Hits album.
Thanks.
Yes, uncle. He's all over it. Uncle Rod, shout out. So I've been with the Rolling Stones since, and then this album, okay, I'm not going to praise it as much as some of the other ones, because I think it's in the middle, maybe not as strong, but to open and to close an album, I don't think there are two better songs on any album, anywhere.
Yeah, it's such an ominous, confident, strong, intense album opener. Talking about Give Me Shelter, you know, Martin Scorsese classic. Good chance if you've seen a Scorsese film that you've heard at least one Rolling Stones song in it, and a chance that it might be that one. With the closer, there's just no touching it. I mean, just beauty. Yeah, heavenly, transcendent.
And Give Me Shelter. Have you seen the documentary 20 Feet from Stardom?
I have not.
So it's about backup singers, just general backup singers, mostly from this time period. And the backup singer, or I would say co-lead vocalist on Give Me Shelter, is Mary Clayton. She's a longtime backup singer. She had, I was also in another group, but I think her vocals on this thing are incredible. And the story behind it actually is she wasn't the first choice for this, but they did end up picking her, woke her up in the middle of the night, brought her down to the recording studio. She's got curlers in her hair and she just unleashes on this track. And it only took him a couple takes too. It's freaking amazing.
I would have loved to have been in the room and just seen their reaction where this person who is sleepy walks in and is like, you woke me up. We're doing this. And just goes full throttle. And that's something that the Rolling Stones did really well, was utilize backup singers so strongly on this album, especially Sticky Fingers. They did it really well. Exile on Main Street, they did a phenomenal job. I mean, they were just on a different level of thoughtfulness and craft, you know, to their peers by this point, with all the layering and, you know, the production wasn't necessarily great. There's some real gritty, raw, jaunty tracks, that just worked really well because of how kind of clunky they were at times, but sung with such bravado.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, I had that in my notes too. I mean, it's almost a slop. It's almost sloppy. It feels like sometimes, yeah. But it works perfectly. Like you said, being in the studio for Give Me Shelter, you can hear Mary Clayton's voice crack at one point, and you can hear Mick in the background cheering her on. He's like, yeah, let's like go. Cause they want the emotion, the raw feeling, that it doesn't have to be perfect. And it doesn't, the whole album's not perfect, but it's really great.
Yeah. And like, I'm such a sucker for, some good jauntiness. Like I love, love, love You Got the Silver with Richards taking control of the vocals, and like Keith Richards, not a great singer. But they're the ramshackle delivery, it's like it works. And I mean country honk.
Yeah, I had the same sort of notes on Country Honk too. I mean, it's did you know? Did you know I found here? It was actually the way Honky Tonk Woman was intended to sound when they originally wrote it. Honky Tonk Woman
That,
came out
huh.
before, but Country Honk is the origin, the version that it was actually intended to be.
Do you know why they switched it up?
I don't. I'm curious as to why they included this on this album, if they said, you know, I want to get this out here because this is really what we wanted this to sound like, or if, I don't know. I honestly don't know the backstory.
Part of me wonders if it was a label thing. Maybe the label forced them to have something more polished, like Honky Tonk Women. I personally prefer Country Honk to Honky Tonk Women. You're going to hear Honky Tonk Women on the radio, but Country Honk just puts its boot heel on it and grinds.
I think throughout this album, one thing that kind of grabbed me more than it had previously is just Mick Jagger's voice. I think it's perfect for this, for exactly what this album is. His voice is perfect.
Last week, you mentioned the lyrics from the band. One lyric that I just absolutely, I loved how sinister and how dark it was on Monkey Man. Well, I hope we're not too messianic or a trifle too satanic, but we love to play the blues. I mean, how f-ing cool is that?
Very cool. Very, absolutely, dude.
Like 19, this comes out in 1969. You know, they're already people freaking out about like the hippie movement and cultism, and then you know you've got the Rolling Stones, one of the biggest bands in the world, saying, "Well, hope we're not too satanic for you," and like, oh my God, shockwaves. Maybe that's the way we're going to get around royalties. By the way, it's just you and I will sing and make instrument noises with our mouths.
I mean, I'm gonna have to sing it up to you because my voice is awful, but I make instrument noises all day long. What do you want?
Yeah.
I got trombone.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to do just like an old timey where I
Ooh. So, speaking of horns, actually, I have it in my notes. So, the French horn at the beginning of You Can't Always Get What You Want might be my favorite use of the French horn in any song ever. Like, I love it. So gorgeous comes then. Can you do a French horn? What's a French horn sound like? You got me?
I've got no French horn. You got a French horn?
Hell no.
We'll have to work on that. Maybe if we talk about an Arcade Fire album, I'll nail the French horn and then I'll nail the hurdy-gurdy. Yeah, any other notes on this one?
The choir on You Can't Always Get What You Want. That's the London Bach Choir with the backup vocals there.
Did they do any other work with them?
I don't know, but I do know that the main reason, one of the reasons they use the choir there, is they liked some of the stuff that the Beatles were doing, which we talked about the Beatles on the first episode. The Beatles have some songs where they've got, you know, a big choir in the background, that sort of thing. So that's one of the reasons they brought it in there.
Did the Beatles use the same choir, or they just were kind of influenced?
Influence, as far as I know.
Okay,
I don't honestly know, but
yeah, I'm scrolling through real quick, and I don't. Yeah, it seems like this was their one-off rock song. And honestly, if you're gonna do or only record one rock song, you can't always get what you want is a good one.
the only other little piece of information I have on this one is this is the last Rolling Stones album that has any instrumentation at all by Brian Jones, the band's founder and original leader.
Yeah, so he died right after so he wasn't even on Sticky Fingers, huh?
They fired him when they were recording this because he was really unreliable.
Yeah.
And he died like a month later, like really soon after. And then they replaced him with Mick Taylor on this one, but Mick Taylor's only on two songs. So really, it's Keith Richards playing both lead and rhythm guitar on most of this album.
I didn't realize he had been that this was his last recording with the band.
You got any final thoughts on that one?
I don't. Do you?
No, the album cover is kind of cool. It's got a record with a ceramic looking cake sitting on top of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. An all-time great rock and roll album cover.
That we talked about is pretty good, too. It's got a big monolith in the middle of a slag heap, and they're all taking a leak up. We'll put these up so you guys can see them. They're pretty sweet.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we'll reenact that last one. All right, so it's time to get to our final segment of the show called Didn't See That Coming, where we ask each other one random question related to today's albums. Jay, you want to start us off?
Sure. So as I mentioned, the Who album was originally part of what was intended to be a rock opera. Joey, if there was a band who was going to write and perform the rock opera of your life up to this point, what band would that be?
Oh, wow. The rock opera of my life. That's really tough. Part of me wants to do a cop-out and go kind of Rock of Ages, where it's just a collection of songs. And for me, it would be like a lot of late 90s radio rock. But if I'm going to choose one band who I think could pull off kind of the lyricism, and you know what, I'm going to go, I'm thinking England classic, I'm going to go with Pulp, who wrote a phenomenal concept-ish album, Different Class. And I feel like they kind of understand my background a little bit, even though I don't know why I assume that. Yeah, Pulp.
I thought you were going to say Insane Clown Posse.
That would be, you know what, maybe they will write the rock opera for the next half of my life.
There you go. I think that's yeah. Cool.
The Joey the Juggalo years, as a middle-aged juggalo.
What you got for me?
For me, three of these bands all influenced dirtbag rock of the late 90s, early 2000s. We've touched on two of them, Power Man 5000 and Kid Rock. We didn't get to Limp Bizkit with The Who. But if you were forced to be in one of these three bands, which one would you choose and why?
So the three bands being Power Man 5000.
Yes.
Limp Bizkit.
Yep.
What was the third one?
Kid Rock.
Oh, hell no. Gotta be Limp Bizkit.
Okay. I respect that choice. So yeah. Yeah. You're going to be displacing Sam Rivers, but that's sorry, Sam.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Hey, and you know what? I'm going to go to my grave arguing $3 bill. Y'all's or $3 bills. Y'all is a great album. Yeah. Why do you choose Limp Bizkit?
I legitimately like the instruments, the instrumentation on Limp Bizkit albums. I do not care for Fred Durst rap rock vocals, but Wes Borland can play the shit out of the guitar, and I'm all about it.
Yeah. I read an article a couple weeks ago about Limp Bizkit that said something to the extent of they were four insanely talented musicians with Fred Durst as the lead singer, and I think it sums up well.
Yeah, I mean, they're a captive to the moment of what was going on at that time. So you can't really blame them. I mean, that is what was going on. You had nu metal, you had rap rock, rap metal, all that stuff. And I mean, Korn, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they were part of the zeitgeist. I can't fault them for that. Friends, thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks to everyone who's listened so far. It means a lot. We hope you lived, laughed, and loved as we explored more of what Jay was teaching us about today. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and rate us. Also, share. Sharing is huge. Next week, we have a very special episode that we've talked about. It could be a real doozy. No spoilers, so you're just going to want to stay tuned for that one. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, I guess just Instagram and Twitter, at Jay and Joey Pod. If you want to reach out to us, our email is jayandjoeypod@gmail.com. If you want to see which albums we'll be discussing and or support this endeavor financially, you can go to anchor.fm/jayandjoeypod. Oh, and we have playlists on Spotify for every episode. You can just follow the link in the show notes to find those. And I believe that is all. So please just be good to each other. That's all we're asking. We'll see you next week.
Later.